From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, as Congress wrangles over bills to extend the administration's secret wiretapping program, some lawmakers grow increasingly frustrated by government stonewalling. The White House wants Congress to grant immunity to the phone companies that violated privacy laws by handing phone records over to the government. But the secrecy over the spying program has placed a roadblock in front of immunity legislation because, as Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter, minority head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said this week on CNN,
"I'm not going to buy a pig in a poke and commit to retroactive immunity when I don't know what went on."
The one telephone company that isn't being sued by citizens or citizen groups for complying with wiretapping programs is Quest Communications. But their former CEO, Joseph Nachio, does have other legal problems. He's appealing his conviction for overstating the value of Quest's earnings. Documents from Nachio's appeal suggest that Quest refused to comply with an NSA wiretapping program almost 7 months before September 11, 2001. George Washington Law School professor Jonathan Turley says we should take these allegations with a grain of salt because they are part of his criminal defense.
But his allegations are supported by other sources. We know, for example, that this administration had an interest in data mining before 9/11. So in that sense, he has some cooperation. It's also true that Quest seems to be the only company that vigorously opposed the government's demands. His entire defense was that the reason numbers were low is because when the company refused to do something that they considered to be unlawful, that the NSA and the U.S. government yanked a major contract that they were relying on. The court would not allow the jury to hear that defense.
Obviously, the phone companies continued to pretty much stonewall about the details of what they did and didn't do. And AT&T and Verizon have told Congress that the White House is preventing them from talking, citing the state secrets privilege. It's kind of you bring it down and say, if we tell you what it is we're supposed to be trying here, the nation's security could be at risk.
You know, I litigated one of the leading cases on state secrets. And that is a doctrine that is much abused by the government, but it is almost entirely used within the court system. Here, the White House is telling companies that they cannot speak to an oversight committee and share information to Congress. That raises very significant constitutional questions of separation of powers and even contempt.
Is it possible that these phone companies should be immune from prosecution if the programs were illegal? Shouldn't the plaintiffs sue the government agencies, as the phone companies suggest? You know, does that seem you're laughing?
Well, just because it won't happen. Look, I sue the government all the time. It's my bread and butter. But that ain't going to happen. The government is going to claim the military and state secrets privilege. The Congress has done nothing to rein in the abuses of that doctrine. So the chances of actually going against the government on something like this is nil. This argument by the telecom companies that, you know, we're the wrong people to sue, frankly, is fallacious. They have a contract with citizens, and they're in the business not just of communications, but of confidential communications. Otherwise, nobody would be doing business with them. It's part of their marketing. It's part of their promise. And what they're saying is that they want Congress to step in and protect them against their own customers who are saying that these companies violated their agreement. These telecom companies are now the only serious barrier in terms of violation of privacy left. Now, in the best of all worlds, we would have a court system that was engaging in reviews and issuing warrants. But both Congress and the White House have now made that impossible.
This whole discussion is predicated on the notion that the government has no case when it says it needs these rights to protect our national security. Data mining is supposed to be an updated way to keep us protected. Do you feel, honestly, that their defense of this endeavor holds no water whatsoever?
Honestly, I do believe that. And the reason is that before 9/11, they had a very powerful tool. There's a secret court that many of us have long been critical of, and the requirements under that secret court were very, very low. It just required some independent review of these surveillance efforts.
But the secret courts were devised in a pre-internet time. The government suggests that demanding these kinds of clearances is unwieldy and dangerous to our security.
Well, those are statements that are rarely tested in the media. They're accepted as true. In fact, the president has suggested that under the old system, before he could issue a wiretap against some individual, they'd have to run and get approval from a judge, and by that point, the call's already been made. That has never been the case. Before 9/11, they could go ahead and wiretap. They just had to eventually go to a judge, explain to them they had to do this under emergency situations, and let the judge review it. But they're opposing even that power. It's not that the administration does not have a legitimate interest here. We all want to make sure that they can do what they need to do to protect the country. But the framers of the Constitution created a process by which citizens can be subject to surveillance. This bill circumvents that process.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
It's my great pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington Law School.
This Wednesday, the Turkish parliament approved Turkish military incursions into northern Iraq to round out Kurdish separatist guerrillas known as the PKK. That vote was seen at least in part as Turkey's response to last Wednesday's vote in a U.S. congressional committee to condemn Turkey for the Armenian genocide of some 90 years ago. Iraqi Kurdistan has been a persistent problem for Turkey. It's also been a friend to the U.S. in a very unfriendly region. Iraqi Kurdistan has also served as a kind of safe haven for journalists, allowing them to be among Iraqis who are welcoming democratic Islamic moderates. And the Kurds are playing to their guests.
Welcome to Iraqi Kurdistan. It's been practicing democracy for over a decade. It's not a dream. It's the other Iraq.
Quill Lawrence is the Middle East correspondent for the radio program The World. He spent much of the last 7 years in Iraq and Kurdistan, and he says the Kurds have found the media can be a mixed blessing.
The 3 months before the U.S. invasion in 2003, when I was stuck there along with many other journalists, there were only so many stories we could do before we started to look at the underside and the corruption and the nepotism and the local party politics in Kurdistan. And there was one case where Netshirvan Barzani, who is currently the prime minister of the Kurdish regional government, made great apologies because someone had arrested a local Kurdish journalist for insulting his family and alleging corruption against them. That was a huge story, and the Kurds found all of their friends they'd been cultivating all these years suddenly reporting on them as abusers of human rights. So it cuts both ways having so many reporters sitting around watching you.
There are three stories about Kurdistan that seem to get written repeatedly. The one about its disputes, especially with Turkey. The one about the deadly gas attacks by Saddam Hussein on the citizens of Halabja. And the one about whether Kurdistan is a de facto nation that could operate separately from the rest of Iraq. Isn't that the trifecta?
Yeah, those are the three stories that people do when they go to Kurdistan.
Now, some of this has to do with these are natural stories to tell, but I gather a lot of it has to do with a pretty persistent PR campaign by the Kurds to guide the coverage.
Yes. Now, you mentioned already the gas attack in Halabja. In the 1980s, the Kurds were really up against the wall. A lot of their leadership realized we aren't going to win against poison gas. We need to come at this at a different angle. They realized that they should start cultivating the media. Now, the current foreign minister of Iraq, Hoshyar Zebari, is a Kurd, and this was sort of his project. He started in London, and he would make himself available to absolutely anyone. You could call him up. He would meet you at any hotel bar in the city to talk to you about the story of the Kurds. They were very savvy about this and did this through the 90s. You could tell that they were practiced at it when the invasion started to come. And in recent years, they've hired very high-power lobbyists to push their case on Capitol Hill, and they started a campaign called The Other Iraq.
In the outreach to the United States, there is lobbying in friendly offices in Congress, but also elsewhere, including some fairly odd bedfellows.
Well, there has been some very interesting and strange relationships with evangelical Christians who've set up shop in northern Iraq. They've even printed up a book called Kurds in the Bible, and it claims that one of the three wise men who's supposed to have attended Jesus' birth was from there. So there's an idea that the Kurds have a role in the Bible.
Now, the Turkish parliament has voted to sanction incursions into Kurdistan, ostensibly to chase PKK guerrillas who are taking refuge in the mountains on the other side of the border. But it happens to come at a time when the United States is at odds with Turkey over the possibility that Congress will condemn the Armenian genocide of 90 years ago. Is it a coincidence that these two conflicts have met this week?
They're not directly related, but what they've done is poison the atmosphere for any sort of gestures of goodwill. Turkey and the United States have had actually a dwindling diplomatic relationship ever since 2003, when the Turkish parliament voted not to let the United States transit through there to invade Iraq. It's not very well known in the States, but Turkey, polls indicate, is extremely anti-American right now, and they see the United States as threatening them through northern Iraq.
Well, on the subject of anti-Americanism in Turkey, tell me about the film Valley of the Wolves.
Well, this is just a perfect example. There's also a popular novel which has essentially the same plot line, that the American invasion of Iraq is intended to set up an independent Kurdistan, which will then steal away part of southeastern Turkey. Even the Turkish First Lady said how much she liked the movie Valley of the Wolves. And again, I don't think people in the United States quite appreciate how poisoned this relationship has been.
Do you believe that the Kurds are going to be able to continue to portray themselves sympathetically in the media? Or will the double-edged sword that you talked about, the reporters running around everywhere, come back ultimately to fill out the story?
I would say they have a great challenge. Still, they've managed to make some inroads in Congress among non-governmental organizations. They're starting to convince people that perhaps there is a place in Iraq that you can invest, and we've seen some small-time oil deals going on in the north. The jury's still out. They're certainly way ahead of the rest of Iraq, where really no one dares set foot outside the U.S. enclave in the center of Baghdad.
All right, Quill. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Quill Lawrence is the author of Invisible Nation, How the Kurds' Quest for Statehood is Shaping Iraq and the Middle East. It will be published in April.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Thursday, Congress failed to override the president's veto of an expanded S-CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Bill. But before the battle was over, two children and one senator came under scrutiny. It began late last month when the Democrats put forth 12-year-old Graham Frost of Baltimore to present the Democratic response to the president's veto.
Most kids my age probably haven't heard of CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. I know all about it because if it weren't for CHIP, I might not be here today.
Sensing a sympathetic subject in Graham, conservative bloggers and pundits, including Rush Limbaugh and Michelle Malkin, went to town. A leading charge was that Graham Frost and his sister attended private school, making them unworthy recipients of government help. Even CNN asked whether Democrats had done enough vetting of their poster child. Turns out the Frost kids are on scholarship. MSNBC's Keith Olbermann was all over the attempt to swift boat Graham. Here's Rachel Maddow on Countdown.
Yeah, 12-year-old Graham Frost, meet Cindy Sheehan, meet 9/11 widows, meet Staff Sergeant Brian McGough, meet Michael J. Fox, meet the kids who were targeted by Mark Foley, meet Jack Murtha. I mean, Graham Frost, as a 12-year-old, now joins an esteemed list of Americans who have been personally attacked, personally slimed, called liars and cowards and frauds, and threatened for daring to publicly espouse a view that the right disagrees with.
Meanwhile, a second S-CHIP poster child emerged, Bethany Wilkerson, a 2-year-old born with a serious heart defect.
Hi.
In the ad, she holds up a sign that reads, "Don't veto me." Well, observed the National Review Online, the Wilkersons wouldn't have had to worry about the veto if Mrs. Wilkerson hadn't been so irresponsible as to conceive Bethany 4 years after quitting a job with health insurance. Yes, chided the National Review, quote, "the couple went on to have a baby anyway." Poster children, whether Graham Frost or David Petraeus, are symbols, and when they are defaced, Congress debates the symbols instead of the issues. James Carroll is Washington bureau chief for the Louisville, Kentucky Courier-Journal. Soon after the controversy started, he began receiving emails drawing his attention to another email Sent from the office of the senator he covers most closely, Kentucky Republican and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Apparently, the McConnell email, sent to selected reporters, repeated the charges against 12-year-old Graham Frost. So it seemed McConnell was propagating the smear.
And I wanted to just nail that down. Did McConnell or people on his staff have something to do with these emails? And by the end of last week, I was still working that story. So we started again on Monday. McConnell's communications director, Don Stewart, called me on the phone, told me, yes, he had sent the emails, first alerting reporters to the fact that the blogosphere was talking about Graham and the Frost family, and then that he had sent emails some hours later, basically waving reporters off and saying, no, the family was legit. There's no story here.
However, it did manage to get, I think, on CNN before McConnell's man called the press off the story.
Right. What had happened until Don had called me last Monday was that McConnell's office was not commenting on the origins of the emails and whether they had something to do with any of it. So that made me, obviously, just even more curious. And so, you know, Don basically told me what he did, what his motivations were, what he was trying to do, and that he said, you know, I helped kill the story on the Frosts.
He neglected to tell you that he helped propagate the story on the Frosts as well?
What he said was that the blogs were actually talking about the Frost 2 days before he sent out his first email, just alerting reporters that this was going on. He said he did not start it. This is what he told me. He did not start it.
Meanwhile, the senator's communications director, Don Stewart, is telling you one thing. At the same time, the senator is telling a different story on TV.
What happened was we published a story last Tuesday morning in the Courier Journal, and WHAS-TV in Louisville had interviewed Senator McConnell on this very subject the previous Friday, in which McConnell said there was no involvement of his staff whatsoever in the emails. WHAS-TV, I am assuming, looked at our story, remembered what he had told them, and thought something here doesn't quite connect. And so that night, Tuesday night, WHAS ran the entire exchange they had with McConnell. The story was already in our paper that morning saying that Stewart had said he'd already told McConnell the day before McConnell was asked by WHAS about this. He had told McConnell about his role in this, but when McConnell was asked the next day on camera, he said there was no involvement by his staff whatsoever.
I guess you're too objective to call that a lie?
I think there's a disconnect.
And what are the consequences here for the senator?
It's part of the game in Washington to try to make your strongest case in any way you can. And Mitch McConnell's office is no doubt going to continue to do that. Harry Reid's office is going to continue to do that. Has this injured McConnell? I don't know. I mean, I've gotten plenty of emails and phone calls from both sides on this. Some people who say, you know, this was terrible and this just exposed his craven political ambition. And other people saying, you know, you're a bunch of socialists and, you know, you're going after a good man who's standing up for America. McConnell's political position in Kentucky at this very moment appears to be pretty secure. But again, he has no opponent yet, but he's gathered a gob of money. The polls show he's got about a 54% approval rating. So will this have any long-term damage? I think only time will tell.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
James Carroll is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Louisville Courier-Journal.
Are you genetically predisposed to sprinting? How about developing Alzheimer's? Two Silicon Valley startups called Navigenics and 23andMe are banking on the idea that consumers will pay to know about their DNA. Navigenics will charge between $2,000 and $3,000 for the information. 23andMe, named for the number of paired chromosomes in a human cell, hasn't named its price yet. Both companies are poised to enter what may be a multi-billion dollar direct-to-consumer biotech market. But what to do with your genetic information once you have it? One idea? Social networking. Think Facebook based on DNA. David Ewing Duncan wrote about the business of genomics in November's Portfolio magazine. He says these companies aim to wow us with our own genetic information.
They will pick out of all this data that they collect on you probably 15 or 20 genes that have some scientific validity and have been associated with diseases such as diabetes and heart attack and even some fun ones like whether your earwax is wet or dry. I guess some people consider that fun. So they'll pick out some of these genes that they think will be marketable to people, and they will provide a subscription service. But what these guys are really offering, that those things are available right now. There are a couple companies online right now that will give you what I just described. What these new companies are going to really do is put together some nifty software with all kinds of information and try to dazzle you basically with a sort of Google Earth of genetics.
You suggested in your piece that people's genetic profiles could be an opportunity for them to create communities around them, you know, in a sort of Facebook social networking style. Is that already happening?
The Facebook sharing idea is already happening with ancestral DNA data. On the disease side of things, I don't know of any sites out there at the moment that are creating these shared organizations, but that is something that 23andMe talked about, at least initially. They seem to have backed off a little on that. I think 23andMe in general started out as, you know, let's have fun with genetics. And I think that they've sobered up a little and realized that some of this information is, of course, very serious.
Well, it's easy to see how this kind of service could revolutionize the relationship between people and their health and their selves, actually. But it's also easy to see how the information can be misused, misinterpreted, abused. For example, just the presence of a gene that may predispose you to a certain disease or disorder does not necessarily doom you to that. How will people be able to, you know, accurately interpret the presence of these various genes?
Much of the bioethics community considers this to be borderline irresponsible, throwing information out to people they may or may not really fully understand and, you know, might scare the bejesus out of some of them. Navigenics and 23andMe will offer genetic counseling. For my book, I've been tested for millions of genetic markers, and for instance, I have the heart attack gene, and I have a 64% greater chance of having a heart attack than someone that doesn't have this gene. And I'm not even sure, after talking, you know, spending a lot of time with geneticists, even exactly what that means.
When people start marching into their doctor's offices saying, you know, I have such and such a gene, what are you going to do about it? How are physicians going to deal with this brave new world?
Well, they're already getting that. In fact, I originally wrote a story for Wired, you know, 5 years ago, which is ancient history in this science. And I did that exact thing. I walked into my internist and I said, okay, I have a couple genes here, you know, one for diabetes, one for high blood pressure. You know, I don't have either of those things. What do you make of it? And he said, I don't know what to make of it. In fact, that's still the state of affairs in the healthcare community. There's not been much training for physicians. And yet, this industry is about to do an end run around healthcare providers. You know, they're going directly to you and me.
Let's say I swab my cheek and get my results back, and it turns out that I have the gene for Huntington's chorea, which dooms me to a horrible early death. Will they tell me?
Well, Huntington's is an almost unique gene. It's fairly rare, although we hear a lot about it. It is one gene or one genetic marker that almost 100%, if not 100% of the people who have that gene will get the disease. I didn't ask any of the companies if they were going to be including Huntington's. My guess is probably not. But there are some controversial ones. I know Navigenics has had a big debate whether to include this Alzheimer's gene. It's called APOE4. That's an incurable disease, and any of the diseases on this list that are incurable, there's still a lot of controversy in the health community of whether this information should be provided.
If genetic blueprints become common currency, it seems to me it's only a matter of time before insurance companies want to see the information, before potential employers want to see the information, before the electorate wants to see the information from candidates in the same way they, you know, get a look at their tax returns. Is this a path that the society really wants to begin to walk down?
I'm not sure that we're even near ready for what we're about to have the possibility of doing with this new science. You could, say, go to a dinner where Hillary Clinton is speaking or one of the other candidates, and they take a drink out of a glass, and you know, you just sort of slip that into your briefcase with the lip imprint on there, and you could take it to a lab, and potentially if you could pull a intact cell out of there, you could run a genetic profile of the candidate and publish that. I mean, imagine what impact that would have. These are all things that are possible right now.
David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Ewing Duncan's new book out next fall is called Experimental Man, One Man's Journey Inside Himself, Cell by Cell. Just a year or two ago, business and tech publications were touting municipal Wi-Fi, that is, free or subsidized wireless broadband internet service for all, coming soon to a city near you. Take a look at the headlines today, and the euphoria has turned to eulogies. Wired magazine declared, quote, an epidemic of municipal Wi-Fi failures, and Slate wrote that citywide Wi-Fi plans have been a, quote, flop. Tough topography, prickly politics, and bad business models have doomed plans, at least for now, from San Francisco to St. Louis. Marguerite Reardon, however, believes reports of municipal Wi-Fi's death have been exaggerated. She's a senior staff writer for CNET, and she joins me now. Maggie, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
First, a quick review. Tell me why some cities have taken it upon themselves to provide broadband service.
In the early days, a lot of this sort of centered around cities looking to use Wi-Fi to do wireless readings of parking meters or of water meters or helping with communication between fire departments and police departments. So once they started looking into building these networks, they thought, well, we could offer this to our citizens. That's how the whole sort of citywide Wi-Fi movement exploded.
Now, cities aren't doing this all by themselves. They have contracted with other vendors to actually do the build-outs and to run the services, chief among them Earthlink. Tell me about these outside entities and exactly how they fit into the picture.
The cities, a lot of them that were first thinking about this, ran up against a lot of resistance from the big telephone companies and cable companies. They didn't like the idea of cities building their own networks and then competing against them in the broadband arena. So a lot of cities dreamed up this idea of a public-private partnership, and that's where companies like Earthlink come in. Earthlink puts up the money, builds the network, and the city basically agrees to let them use their lamp poles and electrical utility poles to put the access points on there, the radios that will give the signals. So that's kind of how the partnership works. And in every city, the negotiation and the contract is a little bit different.
Now, there was the assumption that if you build it, they will come. But this turns out not necessarily to be so. Subscribers have actually been fewer and farther between than anybody anticipated. Why is that?
It just doesn't make a lot of sense for the consumer. The phone company's already offering DSL. The cable companies are offering cable modem service. And then you have a provider like Earthlink who comes in with a Wi-Fi service that is often slower, probably less reliable, and it's not that much cheaper. It's $20 a month, and you can get Verizon DSL in certain places for $15 a month.
Maggie, who's doing it right?
We're seeing some early signs of success. I mean, and I hope this doesn't come back to bite me in a couple of years, but, you know, Philadelphia seems to be doing a pretty good job. Their main focus and their main goal was to bridge the digital divide. And I think they've done a pretty good job with that. They created a nonprofit group, Wireless Philadelphia, that finds the funding. So Earthlink is still making some money, and Wireless Philadelphia is getting grants from other places to fund this. And they're also subsidizing the cost of getting people the equipment, laptops and desktops and things that they're going to need to be able to access the broadband. They're providing training. It's a real community effort. And they're also getting other parts of the city involved. For example, Drexel University is one of the largest users of the network now, and they're providing service for their students and faculty. And that seems to be a great partnership, but, you know, it's still early days, so it's hard to say.
There is something called an anchor tenant, which sounds to me like a lease at the mall to a big department store. How do anchor tenants fit into the economics of municipal Wi-Fi?
Well, at the end of the day, somebody has to pay for the network. So it's really helpful if you can have a big entity like a city, Corpus Christi, or even Houston, who say, you know, we are committed and we'll have a contract here that says that we're going to use X million dollars worth of service per year to provide Wi-Fi to our police department or even just to connect our different municipal buildings together. And that really gives a company like Earthlink some safety where they can say, okay, we know this much is coming in. Then they can start building out services to more citizens, or they can expand into businesses.
Maggie, there's this truism that governments can't do what the private sector can do much more efficiently, especially when there is competition in play. And there's certainly a lot of competition for the broadband marketplace. The cable companies and the telecoms are at each other's throats constantly trying to get their wires into your home. Is it possible that this is just not a job for a municipality, that they should just step back and wait for the market to take care of itself?
We have cities building parks. We have cities that build subway lines, utilities. And I think we could think of communications in the same way. The real problem is, and the reason why we're seeing so many failures now, is we haven't seen the commitment from cities. Why does every citizen need this network, right? Why does every citizen need electricity or running water or subways? I mean, if you want your city to have it, you got to step up to the plate and either make it a good sell to the private company that's going to come in and build it, or you have to put up some money yourself.
Maggie, thank you.
Thank you.
Marguerite Reardon is a senior staff writer for CNET.com.
Coming up, two men, two very different styles of media management.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
The source of our strength is the American people. Hardworking, educated, freedom-loving, God-fearing, family-oriented, willing to sacrifice for the future, freedom-loving American.
There is no presidential campaign this year whose success or failure will so depend on media managers, marketing strategists, and political gurus as that of Mitt Romney. That, according to Ken Silverstein, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, in his November issue report, Making Mitt Romney: How to Fabricate a Conservative, Silverstein explains that the one-time governor of Massachusetts has been rebranded and repackaged for the national market. The question now remaining for Romney and his media handlers is, will you buy the product? A key testing ground is the all-important Republican primary state, South Carolina, where Silverstein traveled widely this summer, and he joins me now. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You had an interesting opening salvo in your piece about suspicions that Romney is a phony and opportunist. You write, by any reasonable standard, it's true. Tell me why it's true.
Well, first off, let me note that that description comes from a campaign document from Romney's own campaign, where they talked about his potential strengths and weaknesses, and they identified one of the potential weaknesses as the view that he is a phony and an opportunist. I said it's true because if you look at his political career, he starts off as campaigning for the Senate in Massachusetts against Ted Kennedy, where at times he tries to be more liberal than Kennedy. I mean, he supports gay rights. He accuses Kennedy of being hypocritical on the issue of abortion and for becoming pro-choice after Roe versus Wade. He even distances himself from Ronald Reagan. So when he's running for the Senate in 1994 in Massachusetts, he's a very liberal Republican. Then when he runs for governor of Massachusetts, he's also quite a liberal Republican. And basically the task confronting the Romney campaign is to rebrand and repackage this guy from the moderate Republican governor of the most liberal state in the union into a red meat social conservative heir to Ronald Reagan who will sell to the Republican base.
Now, we've used the word branding, which may sound judgmental or cynical, but in fact, that's the word his own campaign uses internally, right?
When I was down in South Carolina, I spoke to his chief consultant there, a guy named Warren Tompkins, who ran George Bush's campaign in South Carolina in 2000. And yes, he used the term branding. He said, we've got a branding problem. We have to work harder to brand our guy because Romney hasn't been known to a national audience like McCain and Giuliani. I mean, he certainly wouldn't say Mitt Romney is a phony, but he acknowledged that there were some explanations in order about some of his past stances. I mean, for example, he clearly said on abortion, Governor Romney flip-flopped, and he said that won't be a problem for us because we've been seeking converts. You know, the anti-abortion crowd has been seeking converts since Roe versus Wade, so it'll work for us. But he acknowledged that on that issue, certainly, Governor Romney has changed quite a bit.
Well, on that subject, here is a bit of a YouTube video that captures Mitt Romney in 94 during his failed bid that you mentioned against incumbent Senator Ted Kennedy.
I believe that abortion should be safe and legal in this country. I believe that since Roe v. Wade has been the law for 20 years, that we should sustain and support it. I feel that all people should be allowed to participate in the Boy Scouts regardless of their sexual orientation. Look, I was an independent during the time of Reagan Bush. I'm not trying to return to Reagan Bush. My personal beliefs, like the personal beliefs of other people, should not be brought into a political campaign.
Clearly, when he was running for the Senate in 94, Romney saw that he needed to sell himself to a very different audience than he needs to sell himself to now. And in fact, even a few years ago, Human Events, which is a very right-wing magazine, listed Romney as one of its top 10 rhinos, Republicans in name only. And there's a lot of suspicions on the part of the Republican right that Mitt Romney is not one of them.
Back in 68, the old red-baiting Nixon became the new Nixon, the new China-embracing Nixon. And, you know, Bill Clinton moved quite hard to the right after the 94 disaster for Democrats in Congress. One man's flip-flopping or opportunism is another man's getting in sync with the electorate.
You make a very valid point. On the other hand, I do believe that Romney has to move further ideologically than any of his competitors. And it's very hard to explain. I mean, if you look at other politicians who have made this sort of dramatic shift, they could all sort of point to some sort of political epiphany. I mean, Ronald Reagan was a New Deal Democrat. And then in the early 60s, he joins the Republican Party. You know, he talked about his own experiences in Hollywood, and he had a very, very detailed explanation for his political shift. I would also point out that when Ronald Reagan became a Republican, it was hardly a politically advantageous position to take. Whereas Romney, you go, can you point to some sort of political epiphany? Is there anything that happened that accounts for you moving so far to the right over the last decade or so? And he really can't point to anything.
I want to get back to South Carolina in a moment. But first, I want to go to Iowa and the Ames straw poll. It was very important to Romney. He spent a lot of money. Here's a commercial he aired at that time.
Washington politicians in both parties have proven they can't control spending, and they won't control our borders. I will, but I need your help to do it. So come on to Ames. After all, changing America always starts in Iowa. I'm Mitt Romney.
Well, he got his message across and I guess did very well in the straw poll. At what cost?
At minimum, he spent $3 million in Iowa, $2 million for TV ads, and at least $1 million on organization. They bussed in their supporters. They arranged a barbecue lunch. There was a big direct mail campaign. There was entertainment. They paid for hundreds of what they called super volunteers, which would be anywhere from a college kid to folks they hired and paid $500 to $1,000 just to sort of recruit voters for them. And, you know, in the end, he got 4,615 voters at the Ames straw poll. I calculated that that would have meant at least $650 per vote. and probably that's a dramatic understatement. The calculation is that you win the Ames straw poll and it amounts to a big PR boost and you get a lot of good news out of it and it builds momentum. And they may be right.
But he's still polling low in South Carolina. Is it all because of phoniness and opportunism?
I spoke to a number of conservative officials down there. There's a woman named Cindy Mosteller who told me that she just didn't trust this guy who's running more to the left in Massachusetts and who now is this diehard social conservative. She said she just found it very patronizing to her intelligence, to her conservatism, and to the South. And I think it's been more difficult for him to penetrate that electorate in South Carolina. But, you know, they're spending a lot of money down there. It's a key state for them, and he will come up in the polls. It's just a question of how far.
Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
Ken Silverstein is the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. His piece, Making Mitt Romney, How to Fabricate a Conservative, is in the November issue.
Thank you. Want to hug you all. Love you. Good night.
This week, the Dalai Lama received the Congressional Gold Medal, one of the United States' two highest civilian honors. President Bush attended the ceremony and personally presented the medal to the exiled Tibetan leader. To China, which has occupied Tibet since 1959 and consistently condemned the Dalai Lama and those who support him, it was a powerful symbolic gesture. A spokesman for the Chinese foreign minister said that honoring him has, quote, severely hurt the feelings of the Chinese people and gravely undermined the relations between China and the United States. It didn't matter to President Bush, who explained before the ceremony that he admires the Dalai Lama a lot and that China should hear him out.
I've also told him that I think it's in their interest to meet with the Dalai Lama, and will say so at the ceremony today in Congress. If they were to sit down with the Dalai Lama, they would find him to be a man of peace and reconciliation. And I think it's in the country's interest to allow him to come to China and meet with him.
It's in the Dalai Lama's interest, too.
Although we prefer direct communication with Chinese government, Chinese leaders, we haven't found proper opportunity.
Born in a poor farming village in 1935, he was two when he was identified as the 14th incarnation of the Dalai Lama, Tibet's spiritual leader and head of state. In 1959, he was on the run, living in India. Robert Thurman, now a professor at Columbia University, studied with him there and became the first American ordained as a Tibetan monk.
To me, he was like a really nice young guy, a little nervous and very sweet and friendly. He didn't bowl me over with his sort of superstardom.
He launched his perpetual tour in 1967. He's since met with many thousands of ordinary people, presidents, prime ministers, patriarchs, and popes. He's been on Time's list of the world's 100 most influential people. He's won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's been savaged by Christopher Hitchens. It doesn't get better than that. What's his PR secret?
You know, people ask me often, like, who manages the Dalai Lama's PR and who's his PR firm and all this. And he's never had one. And in fact, sometimes they've been offered pro bono by different PR firms. And his people and himself have always declined because they don't want to be packaged without their own long-term understanding. They want to control their own image.
All he really wants is to get a simple message out about compassion and Tibet. But public relations isn't simple in such a complicated world.
He was on Larry King a bunch of times about 5-6 years ago, and he turned down some other programs. I won't mention names, not to embarrass them, but, you know, that have a 50 million audience instead of 1.2 million audience.
That program was Oprah's.
Tibetans, you know, they come from high altitude, you know, they climb mountains and things, and they herd yaks. And they're very self-reliant.
But, I mean, how self-reliant can you be in New York if you don't know the difference between Larry King and Oprah Winfrey?
I don't know. That's what we say sometimes.
Some of the Dalai Lama's public relations problems are far less innocuous. In 1998, he acknowledged that his administration in exile took money from the CIA in the 1960s, that the country he briefly ruled condoned what amounted to serfdom. He was accused of speaking out of both sides of his mouth on the issue of homosexuality, and he's friends with Richard Gere.
But somehow there seems to be this bounce-back quality to the Dalai Lama, a sort of Teflon thing, that these things just seem to add to his glow somehow.
Robert Barnett is a lecturer in Tibetan studies at Columbia University.
And he doesn't seem to get pulled down by even the slightly more difficult figures like the Steven Seagal, that film star who got declared by one Tibetan Lama to be himself the reincarnation of a 17th century Tibetan Buddhist teacher.
You and I were the same.
There's a difference, my man. You have faith.
I don't.
For real?
For real, yeah. And this really seemed to be the limit of credibility. I mean, a huge number of Buddhists were shocked and horrified by that. And the Dalai Lama carefully distanced himself from that. He seems to have survived it.
There's an old and durable aphorism about media that they love to build those heroes up and then take them down. How come he hasn't been taken down?
I don't know. I have to admit that I'm one of the people who said, you know, 20 years ago, it wouldn't last, you know, and I'm wrong. So I shouldn't be making guesses here.
Maybe it's that particular element in Tibetan Buddhism that seems to bestow enlightenment at random, even on Stephen Segal?
So there is a great appeal to that, that you don't know where these great lamas are going to appear.
Donald Lopez is a professor of Buddhist and Tibetan studies at the University of Michigan.
It could be in Tibet. It could be in California. Anybody's child, at least hypothetically, could be the incarnation of a great lama.
I'm nothing special. I'm just like you.
But maybe we just love the way he combines modernity and tradition, the spiritual with the commercial, literally. Robert Barnett.
He did a series of advertisements once, wasn't it, for Apple computers, which was big as well. You see, where he places himself in front of the modern and in front of the fashionable, all the things that he would appear not to be.
Or maybe we love that movie stars follow in his wake.
Buddhism always caught on first in the royal court.
After all, says Donald Lopez, celebrities are our royalty.
The aristocracy, the nobility, who find Buddhism somehow interesting. And so when people complain, as they often do, that Buddhism seems to be kind of a celebrity religion and all of the Richard Gere and Sharon Stone and so forth are devotees of the Dalai Lama and somehow take offense at that, I think they're missing a larger historical perspective.
And then there are the movies about him or his native land, Bernardo Bertolucci's Little Buddha with Keanu Reeves, 7 Years in Tibet with Brad Pitt, and especially Martin Scorsese's Kundun with actual relatives of the Dalai Lama.
Holiness, the Chinese have moved their camp. The Oracle's route is safe for us now. We must go.
Yes.
Sanctuary has been arranged in India. They're expecting you.
Kundun helped give Tibet an identity distinct from so many other oppressed minorities. Before the current crop of films, there was only 1937's Lost Horizon by Frank Capra, whose Tibet was Shangri-La, pretty much an Oriental Brigadoon.
Tibet always was the empty space on the map.
Robert Barnett.
Not just in Western accounts, even in the first millennium in Arabic accounts, Tibet was being described in this way as the empty space. That really was the space on which people could project fantasies. I think that he's taken that Tibet that's played that role in history and turned it into a sort of personal Tibet. He's now a walking empty space that travels around in which we can place some of those fantasies and actually go and listen to him. And he's humorous and immediate and very tangible. And it seems to be a sort of Tibet that's come alive, even though Tibet, the country, has disappeared.
Barnett believes it's empty space that forms the basis of the Dalai Lama's appeal, the reason why his constituency can range and change from Indian conservatives to American hippies.
What I mean is that the Dalai Lama, in his general talks, is presenting a kind of philosophy and a kind of approach to life that is really not marked by anything in particular. It's almost featureless, just an idea of compassion, treating people well.
Compassion is important because more compassionate mental attitude there, you can see everything more better, more clearly.
It's classically what media people talk about when they try to find neutral terminology, something that could be open to almost anyone who listens to it. My guess is that that's what's made this happen. And I should add one thing. He has received enormous help constantly from the Chinese authorities.
That's the capper. That's what makes Dalai Lamania so enduring. Aside from his profoundly appealing message of peace and love, of course, you couldn't buy a better foe than the People's Republic of China.
They just constantly repeat the kind of propaganda dream of attacking him again and again. It's a bit like a Rottweiler savaging a puppy. They make him look more and more docile every time they bare their teeth.
I have nothing to offer, just to listen, to learn myself.
The Dalai Lama is 72. China's best chance for winning the PR war may just be waiting for him to pass away. But since we're talking about someone who's forever reborn, it could be a very long wait.
So, that's all. Thank you.
Now, That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, with help from Paul Schneider. We had help from Jessica Magaldi and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.